Summer hikes are a scout favorite. Fresh air, big views, and the adventure around every corner. But with heat, rugged terrain, and the unexpected, safety has to come first. In this episode, we're hitting the trail with Tim Treweek, an Eagle Scout, Cub Master, Assistant Scoutmaster, and Wilderness First Responder, to talk about hiking prep, safety, and why Wilderness First Aid is a must for every unit.
Sure, absolutely. That all started, you know, as we were starting to talk about high adventure bases that my daughter might be able to participate in. And that's something I'm really into. I never got to go as a scout. So my initial infatuation with that was that maybe now I can actually go to Philmont or Sea Base or Northern Tier. That would be a new and exciting experience for me. And of course, we all know that they have the requirement that you need one leader who is wilderness first aid trained. So of course I took on the mantle of that. And I looked into the program. For me, scheduling something like that was difficult. So I looked at other outlets for acquiring those trainings. And that's when I learned about some of the other levels of wilderness first aid training that they have, including wilderness first responder, wilderness EMT. Mm-hmm. So being naturally curious, I looked into what's involved in the various formats of those trainings. And I just found that wilderness first responder was a much more robust program with a lot more information. And I thought that I would get a lot more confidence going into the backcountry with youth, taking the first responder training. Pretty much any, you know, it prepares you for anything that you could reasonably have available to you as first aid tools in the backcountry.
And then building on that, you also went through the whole search and rescue component of it too.
Yeah, as a first responder, when Hurricane Helene came to North Carolina and devastated the area, you know, I felt a deep connection with the area, so I had to get out there. And following that experience, I just felt like the skills that I have acquired as a scout, as a scouter, as a wilderness first responder, an avid outdoorsman, that I could be of great use in terms of the search and rescue team locally and in neighboring states. Mm-hmm. So I went ahead and took that training, and it was an extremely rewarding process. Everything I thought about what experience I already have compared to what experiences and skills are needed for that role as a volunteer was exactly on point. So for anybody who knows how to read a map, knows how to read a compass, knows how to survive in the wilderness, knows how to pack their gear and pick the right gear to stay warm or stay cool, depending on the weather, you would actually make a perfect fit for search and rescue. That's some of the main stuff that they're looking for.
Was there like a 20-mile, like big hike and search that you guys did in order to complete that? Mm-hmm. How did that whole process work?
Sure. I mean, the search and rescue program was several weeks of work. There was written portions of it, and then there was field training. The field training was amazing. We did that at a state park in East North Carolina, and we spent 2 days out there in the park going over exercises and scenarios, drills, and just testing our book skills in the field. And as a scout, you know, that came pretty naturally, doing orienteering courses and such. You know, I was at home doing that kind of stuff. At the end of the course, the last thing that we did was a large scale scenario where we started with multiple smaller teams scouting different areas based on information that was provided. And then throughout the day, we condensed those teams into fewer but larger teams as we narrowed down our search areas. And that lasted all the way until about 1 o'clock in the morning. Until we finally combed over the area where our subject was located. So yeah, I'd say we probably covered 20 miles. You know, we're not covering 20 miles in the same amount of time that somebody who's backpacking or hiking
right
would do. It's quite a lot slower, and it's not always, you're not on the trail. You know, a lot of times we were walking through the swamp, wading through the swamp, crawling through briars and bushes and places where people have probably not walked in quite a long time.
Well, that actually brings me to kind of what I wanted to talk about. It's summertime. It's a great time to get out either with the family, with the unit, by yourself, if you wanted to. But you know, as we go into summer, we sometimes let our guard down. So what are some of the basic principles that we need to keep in mind right now as we start planning some either unit or individual hikes and outdoor activities?
So obviously the number one thing that is going to provide a safety net is planning. And that goes from planning out the route, you know, marking it on a map, explaining to everybody using the map where we're going, where we're planning to go, what, you know, what intersections do we expect to see, where are we stopping, where are we starting, and all of that. And also planning in terms of, you know, a plan for what happens when we get lost and how not to get lost. For instance, you want to have someone who is knowledgeable in the lead at the front of the group. You want to have somebody as a sweep in the back of the group. And then your leader usually is somewhere in the middle. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, this makes sure, and I tend to be the person in the back. I like to make sure that everyone has made it to where they're going. I actually get kind of anxious if I'm not in the back because I don't know what's happening to the people behind me or if they're going to make it to where, you know, to where we're supposed to be. Communication is really important. I do recommend, you know, radios for the people in the front and back. You would like to think that your group will stay together. That often does not happen. Mm-hmm. Especially some of the scouters that go on these trips aren't quite as fast as the, you know, the teenagers that are going with them. First aid, obviously, everybody should have a personal first aid kit. Someone should have something a little more robust. You know, one of the things that struck a chord with me when I was doing all this training at the beginning, when we started talking about first aid kits, at one point I ran upstairs and I grabbed my first aid kit out of my backpack and I dumped everything out. And I was astonished because as I looked through the things in my first aid kit, I didn't have a single item in there that could be used to save someone's life in an emergency or trauma situation.
Right.
And that's what kind of hit me because I started becoming anxious about the thought of something bad happening in the backcountry and I don't know what to do or I don't have the things that I need. So I did a lot of work putting together a really, really good first aid kit so that I've got what I need for any situation that I could feasibly bring along on a trip like that.
Right. It's one thing to have a personal first aid kit where you're just treating blisters and cuts and scrapes. But if you actually need to take care of somebody, you need something that's going to be a little bit more substantial, whether that be splints or tourniquets or the things to you know help with more severe traumatic injuries.
Absolutely.
One of the things we talked about is understanding how to help first responders if somebody gets injured on the trail. First and foremost, we should always be on the trail with a buddy, right? Our buddy is always our first line of defense and our buddy should be looking out for us. We should be looking out for our buddy. But outside of that, how can our buddy best help communicate and administer what basic care that they can until the first responders can get there?
Sure. And I mean, scout first aid training is excellent for the age range of the kids that are taking it. And, you know, numerous people have had their lives saved by scouts just exercising the skills they learned in scouting. I think that's fantastic. Beyond that, you know, it's really important, especially like on a hike or somewhere where you're not in an obvious place or an accessible place, that if an incident occurs that you stay put. Scouts should be trained and knowledgeable in several different methods of signaling and have those options available to them. I think everybody should have a whistle and not just like a cheap whistle from the internet, but something, you know, something that's got a very loud sound to it. There's a big difference. And you know, when we did our training, we had a mixed bag of those different whistles that people brought. And there you could tell there was a huge difference in how far the sound of that would travel. Using a signaling mirror is it's a cheap item to have. It's extremely easy to learn. You can see that from miles away. Having something on your pack or in your pack that is brightly colored, like a bright orange, a bright blue, or something like that, that you can wave in the air is really good at getting people's attention.
Yeah, I know that we've intentionally made for our cub units, we've intentionally made our shirts day glow orange or day glow yellow so that we can actually see our scouts out in the woods and know where they're at. But for the sake of being able to spot them and make sure that the scout stands out for their Class Bs, we do teach it. You know, we don't want to be an eyesore for everyone, but at the same time, we want to make sure that they're safe and found.
Absolutely. Now, you're talking about helping search and rescue, first responders. If there's an incident, and one of the main things you learn as a wilderness first responder is when to call for an evacuation. That's a huge portion of it. Being able to do a full patient assessment and knowing, you know, based on what you've determined through the assessment, do we evacuate or not? And if so, how do we self-evacuate or are we calling for a team? And a lot of times it's, you know, you're going to call for a team for some of the more serious things that can happen. And so that brings into question, you know, how do we do that? Conventional methods would have you sending, you know, four of your best hikers back down to the trailhead to find a payphone to make a call. We know that that's not usually an option anymore. With the payphone, and now your cell phone may not even work at that point too. Mm-hmm. So I would highly recommend that any adult scouter who is leading any kind of excursion into the wilderness, into the backcountry, which by definition, wilderness medicine happens anywhere that's 30 minutes away from definitive care. I highly recommend that these groups are bringing along a personal location beacon. So this will be something like the Garmin InReach Mini or InReach Mini 2 or something, you know, depends on what you want to spend, but something more robust. But the main feature on that that's important is the SOS button. Mm-hmm. Now you do need a subscription for it to work, but if you push that SOS button, you'll be put directly in contact with the dispatcher who will be able to get a helicopter or a team on foot to you. You'll be able to communicate what the situation is and what's needed. That's the only peace of mind sometimes that I feel like I have out there. You know, with all my skills and all my training, it only can help me so much if I can't contact emergency services.
Right. Aside from the personal location beacon, what should or shouldn't we do? And do we move the patient or do we wait for help to come to us to then move the patient?
So I think you're going to find some differences in what scouts would consider their protocol on that question and what someone who's a wilderness first responder would consider their protocol in that situation. There's a lot of things where as a wilderness first responder, we're going to call for an evacuation or at least request an evacuation. Whereas, you know, scouts, I know as a scout, we've learned different ways of transporting people and moving them around. But most injuries, and usually we're talking musculoskeletal injuries, as far as, you know, you can't continue on. But there's also illnesses and there's heat and cold related injuries. And, you know, I think it's really important what I've learned as far as what is the threshold for initiating an evacuation. Now, when you get in communication with that authority, they may advise you to try and self-evacuate. But that's going to be something that you do based on their recommendation as far as what they're capable of. But most of the time, you know, let's be realistic. The only situation I can think of is, you know, when we do our scene size up, you know, when we see that there's evidence of an injury or a traumatic experience, we size up the scene. One of the first things we do is we determine, is the scene safe? If it's not safe, then we may decide to move that subject out of that dangerous situation. And there, yes, we might, as carefully as we can, move them out of that dangerous situation. But for the most part, you don't want to move the patient. Mm-hmm. If we have evidence of a spinal injury, or or something that could have caused a spinal injury, we will not move the patient. In fact, we'll stabilize the patient, we'll stabilize the cervical spine, and we'll do a full head-to-toe assessment followed by a focused spine assessment. And if they don't pass the four components involved in that check, then we do not move them. We call for a helicopter. If we knew beforehand it's probably going to be really bad, we might just already have called for the helicopter, and we might not even do the focused spine assessment.
If we tapped into both the first responder element and your search and rescue element, how is it best for units? Should they have an evac? Should they have an issue where somebody got injured and they need to call for that evac? How do they best communicate their location if they don't have a GPS location? And then how do they best communicate the injuries? What should they also not do that could sometimes complicate things?
That's a great point. If you're familiar enough with your map and you know where you are on your map, you're actually using it as you go on this trip and you can accurately identify where you are, that's great. There's also many ways of using a compass and your surroundings to determine exactly where you are on that map. I think one of the map reading skills that may be less common in individuals is being able to specify a point on the map for someone else, like give a coordinate, essentially. And most of the time when we're doing that in search or in rescue, we're not doing that in terms of degrees. It's we're using the USGS grid or the UTM grid, which gives us a much more simple version of coordinates based on a certain map of a certain area. And that's, you know, that's a big skill involved in search and rescue. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're not familiar with those, that's fine. You can still use standard coordinates if that's all you are familiar with or have access to. One way you can do that is if you do have a phone, if you have an iPhone, for example, you can go into your compass and the compass app that's already on there, and it will tell you your current coordinates. And there's some other apps that can do that too, something like CalTopo, or I believe AllTrails can do that. Mm-hmm. You might even be able to ask Siri if Siri can tell you what your current coordinates are. And that's a pretty accurate way of communicating your location, usually within about a 10 meter range, which is more than accurate enough for somebody right. to find you.
And then in terms of communicating injuries, like what do we need to be able to state clearly to the first responders so that they come prepared?
I don't know that the dispatch is going to give you input on if you should or should not evacuate. That's really up to the medical professional on the scene, which would be the person with the highest level of training. Mm-hmm. As far as communicating that information to them, we want to be as objective as possible. And we also don't give the patient's name over the radio. We describe them as, you know, their age, their gender, you know, maybe height and weight or something like that, if you can guess, just to give them an idea of who we're dealing with. And then as far as describing the injuries, you're objective with it. So it's not your opinion on what's going on, but your observations through the patient assessment and through what the patient, if possible, has relayed to you. Mm-hmm. So we can tell them about what the chief complaints are from the patient. We can give them information about their level of responsiveness. How responsive are they to certain stimuli? You can let them know, have they lost consciousness? But we want to be as objective as possible. We want to use plain terms.
Very cool. Well, thank you for sharing your thoughts. Tim Trewick is the wilderness first responder and a wilderness search and rescue expert. He's also a Cub Master and Assistant Scout Master here in the Cardinal District. And we thank you for taking the time today.
Thanks for having me on, Chris. It's great to be here.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Scouter's Compass. If you enjoyed today's show, be sure to follow and share it with your fellow Scouters. This has been a production by the Cardinal District and Okanichi Council of Scouting America. For more information, visit www.ocscouts.org. Our theme music is by Dan Liebowitz. Until next time, I'm Chris Michaels. Stay sharp, stay kind, and keep scouting forward.